welcome to the Hyphen Church Podcast, where faith meets the spaces in between. We're here to explore what it means to belong, to grow, and to encounter God in the midst of life's questions and complexities. Whether you're here to listen, reflect, or take a step forward, know that you're in the right place. Let's make space together for what God is doing in us and through us. Now, let's dive into today's message.
We are in Catching Fire. This is a series that we started last week, and we're going to look at the first eight chapters of the book of Acts, the Acts of the Apostles. How did the church start? And it's not really talking about the church quite yet, because the name Christian doesn't come around till Acts 11 or so. And so we want to look at how are those that were practicing the way, specifically the apostles, those that were close there, the 500 that Jesus showed himself to, how are they practicing life and how is the Spirit intervening in that? Last week was Pentecost in the global church. I preached on Ascension and I'm going to preach on Pentecost this week just because I didn't want to do things out of order. But the idea of the Spirit coming to the church, the idea that after those 40 days that Jesus was there on earth, then something happened. He sent the Spirit. He sent that helper. And so we want to look now at Acts 2 and the idea of what happens now. We've asked that question last week. When will you do this? When, God? When is the question that we listened and heard so much of last week? And the Spirit's going to kind of answer that question this week. He's going to show up on the scene because of something that has happened, and we want to follow along with that. So, chapter 2, verses 1 through 13 in Acts says this, "When the day of Pentecost came, they were all together in one place. Suddenly, a sound like the blowing of a violent wind came from heaven and filled the whole house where they were sitting. They saw what seemed to be tongues of fire that separated and came to rest on each of them. All of them were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other tongues as the Spirit enabled them. Now, there were staying in Jerusalem God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven. When they heard this sound, a crowd came together in bewilderment because each one heard their own language being spoken. Utterly amazed, they asked, 'Aren't all these who are speaking Galileans? Then how is it that each of us hears them in our native language? Parthians, Medes, and Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judah and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and parts of Libya near Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and converts of Judaism, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues.' Amazed and perplexed, they asked one another, 'What does this mean?' Some, however, made fun of them and said, 'They've had too much wine.'" Will you pray with me? Father God, send your Spirit this morning. Help us to dwell in that space that we can have this illuminated in our lives, that we can understand the words that you've been giving to us. Open our eyes and let us hear it in our own tongue and our own words, that we can catch this fire that has been brewing. In your Son we pray, amen. So, lightning and thunder. When lightning strikes, the work has already been done. We don't need to wait for the thunder. We don't need to know that the thunder is coming. The lightning is there. That's the part that's producing the thunder at the end. You see the flash, and sometimes I remember as a kid, I would used to count one Mississippi, two Mississippi, and that would tell me how far the lightning strike was away from the house. And the gap between the flash and the sound is not the moment lightning has decided to be real. Because we can't hear the thunder yet doesn't mean the lightning hasn't struck. The lightning has struck and the thunder is on its way. It's coming. It's not here yet. The gap is really just a geography. The gap is how far away we are from the lightning strike. And Luke writes about a church in Pentecost that's living in that gap. That lightning has struck, the Spirit has come down, but we're kind of waiting for that thunder to come through. What does it mean that the lightning has fallen? What does it mean that it has struck here in the church and these people in this moment? And where does that thunder come from? How do we hold on to that? Well, I want to sort of preach this backwards a little bit, because I think one of the more interesting parts of this passage is the verse 13. The last line that Luke puts in this passage, the note that he leaves ringing at the close of the most dramatic moment in the early church's history, doesn't belong to God. It belongs to the people on the outside. Why mention this at all? Luke writes about these mockers. Well, it looks like they're drunk. It looks like they've had too much wine. They're full of this whatever thing that's going on here. And Peter doesn't speak until verse 14. So the lightning has struck and the thunder has not come yet. And we're living kind of in this spot where, what do we do with this thing? It doesn't really interpret itself. The fire has fallen, winds, flames, new languages. The disciples have done exactly as they're told. And last week, Jesus refused to answer that reasonable question. When will the kingdom be restored? And his answer was, it's not for you to know. And so in this absence, there is a timeline. And the disciples do the only thing left to do. And that is they gather. They come together in one room, and they're sitting there together in this room. And so we have this ordinary sentence. They were all together in one place. There's no theological achievement. There's no spiritual intensity. They were just together. And in fact, I want you to notice something about this, because when Pentecost is preached, or when we talk about Pentecostal fires, or we talk about an apostolic or Pentecostal church, a lot of emphasis is placed on the tongues part, the speaking in tongues, which is not speaking in unknown languages. It's here in Acts 2 speaking in a language that seems to be translated by the Spirit. That seems to, that as I'm talking to someone who doesn't speak my language, they can understand what I'm saying. And that's only lasts for four verses, though. 15 or 5 through 13 talk about what Luke wants to talk about. He only spends just a little bit of time in what the Spirit is coming and how the Spirit comes, and what happens is 5 through 13. And that is more interesting to Luke. He spends almost three times as many verses on the crowd's reaction as the fire itself. And so why does he end there with the mockers? They are full of wine. And look at this crowd. They're all devout Jews. They're here for the pilgrimage feasts of Shavuot, and they're minding their own business, their own religion, and something interrupts them. Something new comes on to the scene. They hear the sound, they come running, and Luke is careful about their response, their astonishment and perplexity, and then the honest question, what does this mean? Which really is the exact question. They're standing in this gap, and they're wondering, what does it mean now that people are wandering around acting like they're drunk? What does it mean that we see this fire from heaven? And so they're reaching for laughter instead, because they're uncomfortable. They don't know how to react to the situation. They don't know what's going on. The trouble here isn't that the Spirit failed to come. The Spirit came and was powerful and unmistakable. The trouble here that Luke is putting us into is that after the fire has fallen, the crowd is divided and the mockers have the last line. It's that fire falls and the Spirit comes, and it doesn't solve all of the problems. The Spirit doesn't clear everything up as he comes, as the fire falls on the believers there. It doesn't do it in a way that we can control. It doesn't do it in a way that we can manage. But we, in our lives, we've decided that thunder is kind of the point, right? That the Spirit is here and the room has to be shaken for believers. And we have to enter into the lives of unbelievers and they have to be shaken with an experience between God and the Spirit. And we're not really sure that the lightning that's already struck the church, we're not sure that that really counts. Not until at least we hear the sound of the thunder. Not until someone can come along and shake us with that sound. Until there's really a response that we can measure, a change that we can verify, a result that kind of closes the internal gap. And so we've become manufacturers of thunder. We've become manufacturers of that experience. That the Spirit falls and we want somebody to do something with that. We manage the environment, first of all. The lighting, the music, the pacing. We try and create these conditions where response feels more likely, where the gap between the fire and the world's response feels shorter and more navigable. We started this trend called seeker sensitive because the fire has hit, the Spirit is here, but nobody knows what it means. What does it mean? How can I be a part of this? We don't take the Spirit at its own value, at its own dwelling, at its own pace. We instead say, I have to create an environment where the people who enter into it are going to be affected by that Spirit. Because I just don't trust the lightning. I have to create the thunder on my own. Or how about this? We manage our language about faith to keep the bewilderment inside a more comfortable range, to give people just enough category for what they're encountering that it won't reach for mockery. We don't want to be a laughing stock. We don't want to be the butt of the joke. You know, we see crazy Christians out there from time to time. Like, gosh, they're giving us a bad name, aren't they? I wish they would just, you know, sit down and you know, behave like the rest of us. And we manage those expectations that we have. We manage the way that we feel about how we talk about God to the people around us. Because we don't want to be the crazy Christian. We don't want to be that one. Of course you're saying that. Of course you believe that. We manage our own witness so it reads as reasonable. We soften the edges of what we actually believe because we are living every single week in the gap between the fire that we've been given and the world's reception of it. Let's downplay it just a little bit. I go to a church and I'm a Christian, but I'm not one of those kind of Christians. We soften the language. We downplay our own witness because when we feel the failure, when someone laughs or someone doesn't believe or someone walks away without having the experience that we wanted for them, and we say, this must be a failure because here is the Spirit, and here am I praying for all these things to happen. Here I am praying for the world to move. And it doesn't happen. And so I feel like I've failed somehow, that I haven't called the name of the Spirit in the right way. It's not mine to manufacture, remember. It's not mine to move the Spirit. We feel it when we've done everything right. We've shown up and we've gathered and we've prepared and we've prayed. And the result is still this divided room when someone who had every reason to be moved walks out and says, I didn't feel anything today. Like, pastor's sermon didn't really hit me right where I needed to be hit. oh, the worship, not that anyone would say this, worship was so boring. No one's ever said that. I know that for a fact. But the worship, it just didn't work for me today. Oh, that communion, let me tell you what. I was not motivated to do good things after communion today. And those prayers. Oh my goodness, who are we praying to? Everyone has a reason to be moved and walks out feeling unmoved, and we feel like maybe this has been a failure. Maybe we prayed in the wrong way, or maybe I came with too much baggage this morning, or maybe there was something that happened during the week and I was too distracted. Or maybe I'm just not paying enough attention to the Spirit. When a congregation is small and the work is hard and the question is, when will this amount to something? It feels less like a disciple's theological error and more like a reasonable pastoral grief of, when will this thing make sense? When will this thing take off? When will the Spirit move? And remember, we can't ask that question. We can, but we're not going to get a response. Because the timeline, as we learned last week, is not ours. And the trouble is this, is that we've absorbed somewhere in our belief of the church the idea that if the fire is real, it will be undeniable. That because we walk away with such a strong feeling of the fire, we walk away with such a strong feeling of an experience with Jesus, that it will be undeniable in the lives of the people around us. The genuine Spirit movement produces results that are legible and measurable, and if we're honest, kind of vindicating. I got to be honest that I feel really proud when God answers my prayers. I feel like I had a role in that, that I did something that, wow, this is amazing. I prayed over a couple one time that were having trouble conceiving a child. They had tried for 3 or 4 years and they'd been to doctors all over the place. And I said, well, I'd like to pray over you. And I prayed over them and they became pregnant. And for a little moment in my life, I was like, yes, I did something of value. I gave that couple a baby. It feels vindicating when those things happen, right? But we know that's not the way it works. This is the Spirit moving as the Spirit moves. It's not, oh, when, Lord, will this happen? It is, we have gathered, we have stayed. We think that the thunder will come quickly enough to prove the lightning. And when that gap stretches, when the mockers get the last line, when prayers aren't answered fast enough, when the bewilderment doesn't resolve into clarity, we begin to wonder whether the flash we saw was real at all. Maybe that thing that we were waiting for wasn't the Spirit at all. Maybe that thing that I felt in my life wasn't really the Spirit moving at all. And so we go back to manufacturing thunder. We try to fill the gaps ourselves. We put it into our own tongue. We try and interpret it for the people around us, and we try and explain to them what this is like, what it's supposed to feel like. When Thomas Edison first demonstrated electric light in December of 1879, not everyone was super impressed by what he did. Gaslight companies assured investors that technology was impractical. It was just a simple parlor trick. It would not catch on. And the New York Times ran a skeptical piece, but the flame was already caught. The future of electric light was already underway, but the people whose livelihoods depended on the old system had every incentive to call it new wine. Just a fad. And to fill the gap, with dismissal before the thunder arrived. And the church has often been Edison in this story. We know the fire is real and we spend enormous energy trying to convince people who we are that it's not some parlor trick. But that's not our job. The thunder is coming. Eugene Peterson says this, the assumption of spirituality is that always God is doing something before I know it. So the task is not to get God to do something that I think needs to be done, but to become aware of what God is doing so I can respond to it. We've been trying to manufacture the thunder because we've stopped trusting that the lightning has already struck. The fire has already come. We don't have to get out our fire starters. So we flip it. How do we perceive the grace of God? What does God do about this? Well, what does Luke record? In that very first verse, that ordinary text, that ordinary line, fire fell on a rowdy group. Fire fell on a group that was praying ecstatically. Fire fell on a group that had just built this great big testament and altar to God. No. Fire fell on an ordinary room. When will you restore Israel? I don't know. That's not for you to know. So they gathered and they gathered and they gathered, and that's it. And the Spirit didn't wait for a more impressive gathering of people. It didn't require the right conditions or the right level of readiness. It arrived into ordinary presence. And it distributed itself on everyone. Which is an interesting part because we think that the fire comes to individuals. We think that the Spirit falls on individuals. But what Luke is showing us is that the Spirit comes and falls on everyone who's gathered. It's not some concentrated power in the one most worthy, but spread across the entire room. So we might say it like this, God doesn't fall on the resume, he falls on the gathered. Luke doesn't tell us the disciples were praying with any unusual intensity or fasting or had reached some sort of spiritual threshold of readiness. By the way, have you read the Gospels? The disciples were not the ones leading out in front of spiritual readiness, by the way. At every turn, they did not understand this. They did not really get the picture. They were all together in one place, one accord, one mind together. The fire didn't fall on the spiritually proven, it fell on the room. And so this is a direct result of that question from week one. Jesus refused the win and redirected the disciples toward witness. And this is what that redirection produced. They stopped asking and they simply gathered together. They moved from win to together. It's really the natural result of having no answer. What should we do? What does this mean? When will this produce something? I don't know. But let's gather anyway. Let's see the Spirit in the room. Let's see lives changed in a small amount. Because we're not asked to understand the timeline. We're not asked to control the Spirit. We're not asked to call that fire from heaven. We're asked to receive and witness, which leads us to gather. And then notice what God does with the crowd's confusion. The bewilderment is not incidental. It is by design. What does this mean is a question the Spirit creates in order to be answered. The crowd's confusion is not a gap in the plan. It's a stage of the plan. The question of what is this thing is part of the plan. It's a stage in our walk. It's a moment of our growth. When will this happen? It's not for you to know. What is this thing? I don't know. Gather together and find out what it is. Find out what you're doing here. The gap between the Spirit moving and the meaning becoming clear is not a failure. And what does this mean is not a hostile question. It's the right question. It's the question Luke wants his readers to sit with. And even the mockery of the last line, it's not a Spirit failure. God has already done what God came to do. The fire fell, it caught, and it's complete. And so the mocker's line doesn't undo what landed on the people in that room. God is not waiting for other people to reach some sort of favorable verdict for what he's doing in the world. The fire will fall, and we don't have control over that. The Spirit will come and dwell, and we don't have any control over that. And we don't need to wait for people to get it together. We don't need people in the room who approve of the things we're doing. The fire falls, and we gather. Because that's what we have been called to do. The church was not born after that gap closed. Confusion and what is this? And I think they're drunk. And when will this happen? All of those questions happen in that gap. Spirit doesn't manage the response. It falls and it leaves the room. And there's room for bewilderment. There's room for questions. There's room for ridicule. There's room for divided opinions in the church. The most spectacular outpouring of the Spirit in history produces mockery, bewilderment. And I think there can be sometimes this vindication, this triumphant reading of Pentecost, that when the Spirit falls, that everything is resolved. I've brought a helper for you. The disciples receive power, Peter preaches, thousands are saved, the church is born, it is glorious, it is certain, it will never fail. And all of that is true, but it doesn't happen here. The birth of the church is a little bit of a misfire from the point of view of the outsider. Because the fire falls and the church is born and the crowd is confused and they're called drunks. And it's not born in triumph. It was born in a space between this fire falling and this confusion. And we should expect that when the Spirit moves in our midst. It will look strange to people on the outside. And sometimes it will look strange to us. We don't have to manage the world's confusion, especially since we can't. But that also means that we can't manage our own confusion. We can't manage our own bewilderment to what does this mean? Well, it means that we continue believing and trusting in God. It means that we gather together despite and in spite of the things that we don't understand or the things that we don't know. We don't have to have a theological answer, a theological reason, a spiritual awakening for everything that happens in our life. Some things will happen. And we trust the Spirit. We trust that when lightning strikes, that thunder will come and we will understand that this was worth it. That everything that we took into account, every move that we made, every opinion we held, whether wrong or right or in between, the Spirit will come and bear fruit in that. The crowd's question is an invitation, not an obstacle to overcome.